it occurred to me the other day when I was getting ready for this show that this is going to be, much like our Harry Potter page to screen, it's going to be an annual tradition, because The Lord of the Rings, the Fellowship of the Ring came out 20 years ago in, you know, December 2001. And then the subsequent films came out pretty much just a year after. So we've got Two Towers next year and Return of the King the year after. So this is really exciting. I'm particularly excited to talk to you about movies that I now adore, which I hated, and I mean hated with the fiery, hot passion of Mordor the first time I saw them. But this is page to screen, so I'm going to defer to you, my resident fantasy book reading aficionado. What is your history with The Lord of the Rings, the books and the movies, and what do you make of them just in general?
Yeah, so I enjoy Lord of the Rings in many different ways. I have a lot of different kind of threads that connect me to the series. The movies in particular, it was something that, like, if we ever went to Target with my family when I was younger, my dad would always let me get the latest Lord of the Rings DVD that just came out, because he knew I liked the fantasy stuff and he knew that was within that world, but he is not a fan. Like, you know, I talked to him about dragons and he's like, what? Like, it's very confusing. So it's nice to have that connective tissue there. But I never was like big on seeing them in theaters. And the books are an interesting factor for me, because there are so many people in the fantasy world who like to gatekeep, and they say, you know, these are the series that you have to read to be a true fantasy fan. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about this in the past, so I won't harp on it, but I don't subscribe to that notion. If you read and enjoy fantasy, you are a true fantasy fan, you know? And if we can find books in common, that makes me happy to meet you as a fantasy fan. But that said, I felt the force and the push of gatekeeping. So I was like, I have to read Lord of the Rings to know where all of this came from, right? So I read it. And I had read Fellowship for an epics class that I took in college. And I kind of enjoyed it then. It was one of the few books that I actually read all the way through that I was supposed to read for school. But just a few years ago, I started reading the series again because Erin started reading it and really liked it. And it was kind of her gateway into some fantasy as well. So I read Fellowship and I was like, oh my God, this is boring as all hell. And it was very much 150 pages of the Shire. And then and then the quest, you know. And then I read The Two Towers. And then I read, obviously, Return of the King. And I've read The Hobbit way long ago. And the feeling I get about these books, and I risk a lot of stands coming after me for this, is they are dense, difficult reads compared to a lot of modern fantasy that is very much owing a lot to Lord of the Rings. Like, don't get me wrong. This is like the nexus point in many ways, not in every way, but in many ways, Lord of the Rings is the nexus point for what fantasy is now. Mm-hmm. And I find the books incredibly difficult to get through, because it is old prose, it is dense, and it just feels antiquated to me in a way. That said, the story is just amazing. And I think it's still unparalleled in many different ways, which we'll talk about when we get to the movies. But the anecdote I'll end with here is, I have a friend who I talk to every day now, and he is just getting into fantasy and sci-fi in a way that he never realized he could. And about 2 years ago, he said, hey, what should I read? And I gave him a list. I was like, you know, here's some books you would enjoy. And he goes, okay, I'm going to try Lord of the Rings because I need to know what this fantasy is all about. And I politely said, that's a dumb idea. I said, like, you know, if you want to get into fantasy, get into it and then understand where it came from, because you might bounce off if you're a new reader. Hmm. Sure enough, 100 pages in, he texts me and he goes, this isn't for me. I'm not a fantasy guy. And I was like, back up there, friendo. You are a fantasy guy. You're just not ready for Lord of the Rings just yet. So this is all to say, and now he's huge into fantasy. He loves it. This is to say that Lord of the Rings carries with it a certain amount of baggage, and everybody
would you call it Bilbo baggage?
I would call it Bilbo baggage. Okay. You know, and once you get to Bag End, you can drop it off. You know, but I just think that your enjoyment of the series in any capacity, film, book, whatever, largely depends on how much of that burden, that baggage, you're willing to carry with you. And I think there are a lot of Lord of the Rings fans who are willing to shoulder tons of it. And that's amazing, because I love the fervor with which these fans embrace the series. And I think it's a wonderful thing. And I've experienced it with other series, you know? And I'm happy I've read it as a, where did fantasy come from? Where did it kind of start in the popular zeitgeist? But I have my issues with it. So it's kind of a neutral-ish stance, leaning pretty positive to Lord of the Rings. And this viewing of Fellowship actually pushed me a little more towards that positive side. And we'll get into that later. But that's kind of where I stand with it. It's a tentpole series that deserves all of the accolades it gets, but should not be used as a tool to stop people from feeling like they are a true fantasy fan.
Well put. I mean,
and now we're at time, so this has been a great episode.
We only got to the page, sir. We didn't get to the screen. No, a couple of things. I love Tolkien's prose. I read Fellowship, and I haven't read the other books because I read Fellowship for this particular podcast. Mm-hmm. And also, I should clarify that we are going to be talking about the extended editions of the films, not a compare contrast of the theatrical versus the extended, because honestly, I saw the theatrical 20 years ago, and this is the second time I've seen the extended edition. So I couldn't point to you and say, oh, this was missing, and that's why this doesn't work, or this works better than the other one. But I will say, I'm not really a modern fantasy reader. It may just because I'm old as hell and old prose doesn't bother me, but I didn't find it particularly challenging. What I found in terms of the words, what I found challenging and what I think is kind of brilliant in its own way, but I'm also surprised, maybe it's because The Hobbit came out and was successful, that fans were kind of on Tolkien's wavelength, that he could get away with releasing Fellowship. Not a whole lot happens, and it's very much right. The first part of a book. And I don't know if he was out there with like billboards and signs and stuff saying, no, there's two other books coming after this, because it really ends right as the story is beginning. Right. And I could see being frustrated as a fan, like, wait, how long do I have to wait to see the next part? I imagine it's like a lot of people with George R. R. Martin and the Game of Thrones, you know, finale. Yep. But I love the prose. What I think the challenge for me is, especially getting up and reading these things at 4 o'clock in the morning, this is not exactly coffee time reading, is he really captures the idea of going on this incredibly long journey through repetitive landscapes. Even though there are varied landscapes, the time they spend in there, he gets very repetitive in terms of the way he describes things. So at one point, it's frustrating, because how many ways can you describe, you know, a babbling brook? But on the other, it really puts you in the mindset of like, they're on this journey. It's very solemn. There's not a whole lot of talking, because the characters are kind of gearing up for whatever might lay ahead. The first thing that lays ahead of them is, you know, frankly, a lot of boredom and discovery of exciting things that happened long ago. So you're kind of left to imagine, oh, what was this battle that they found? They found like this hilltop kind of burnt out fortress. And, you know, there's references to The Hobbit and all that other stuff. I have not read The Hobbit. I saw The Hobbit movies, so I have some frame of reference. And I think that's kind of cool, because you know, Tolkien was kind of doing the prequel thing way before, you know, prequels were a thing. There's all these different callbacks, but even if you haven't read that story, it's almost like you, in the middle of the book, you realize that there is a whole other story that you can go back and read, and it kind of creates this hunger to find out more. But the other thing that I think is relevant to this conversation is in terms of the idea of gatekeeping and finding a way in, you know, I got a copy of Ernest Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea for Christmas, and I requested it because it was one of those things where I'm getting older now, and I'm like, hopefully have a lot of time left, but you kind of start thinking like, I've lived half of my life and there's still all these books and movies and things that I've never read or seen. So I should start, you know, finding out what this is all about. And so I thought I'd start with Hemingway. And when I got the book, there were so many people around the Christmas table were like, you asked for that? Like we were forced to read that in school and it sucked. And I'm like, yeah. And I realized that Hunter Thompson, who is a much more exciting writer, you know, we've talked about his works on the show in relation to movies and books. Yep. He was a huge Ernest Hemingway fan. And my gateway to Hemingway, if I had not had that in through Thompson's work, I don't know if I would have appreciated The Old Man and the Sea, but reading Hemingway now, I can see a lot of Thompson in that, not necessarily the Gonzo, like it makes Lord of the Rings, it makes Fellowship look like the climax of the Two Towers in terms of things that actually go on. It's literally just an old man in a boat trying to catch a giant fish, but it's the way that the Hemingway wrote that really makes it kind of exciting and evocative. Watching Fellowship again, I noticed just how well Peter Jackson captured and the screenwriters captured what Tolkien did, even when they cheat and they add stuff that wasn't in the book, particularly in the end, which I had to go back. You know, there was about a week difference between the time I finished the novel and watched the movie again. I had to go back and look at the last five pages of the book. I'm like, there was no giant battle. It ended with Frodo watching his friends have a conversation in the woods. But I didn't mind that because that is kind of a harder sell, even though you've got all the Tolkien diehards are going to make, you know, this movie a billion-dollar success regardless. You kind of have to abide by those movie rules and say something kind of big has to happen as a cliffhanger. They can't just be like, yeah, he watched his friends from afar and then decided to walk away on his own. It doesn't work.
And it's funny how well it works in the books. You know, there's a certain artistic flair to Lord of the Rings that I really enjoy, and it's the world building. Mm-hmm. And it's like Tolkien crafted, and this is not to say that people didn't come before him doing this, but this was the first example of like a massively popular fantasy series that was like, this world has thousands of years of history, borderline or possibly exceeding our own, you know? And it's like, this exists on a grand timeline of thousands upon thousands of years, and you're getting a little snippet of it. And when you read the book in that context, or even watch the movie, it kind of makes every little thing seem huge because you are under a magnifying glass. You are experiencing this moment because this is the story Tolkien chose to pull out. You know, it wasn't, he has the Silmarillion, obviously, but like there is so much to it that when you go into this hyper-specific moment of Frodo just deciding to go off on his own, that is backed by all the context of the danger that was built up 4,000 years earlier. So there's a weight to it that if you understand where everything is coming from and what this world means, makes the ending more climactic than it could ever really appear on screen. So I understand a lot of the decisions they make. And help me out here because in the book, and this is a spoiler, so fair warning, but it's Lord of the Rings. Boromir doesn't die until the beginning of Two Towers, if I remember correctly.
Well, I've not read the Two Towers. So,
well, does he die?
No,
at the end of Fellowship.
No, he doesn't. And that was kind of the big,
right,
you know, aghast moment because I'd seen the films and I was like, okay, so this is very interesting because I feel like they kind of take Jackson took some liberties with what happens with the Boromir character, who ends up sort of being the traitor of the Fellowship. Not really. He's under the influence of the ring, but my memory was that he had kind of sold out the Fellowship to the Dark Lord, but that didn't actually happen. But in the book, there's one major scene. He's a suspicious character throughout, but he only has one kind of meltdown, and that's with Frodo in the forest at the climax, when he basically demands the ring and he's saying like, if I had this ring, I would be noble and I'd do the right thing with it and all that stuff. And then Frodo escapes. And then Boromir, once the ring has sort of left his presence, he collapses and he's like, I'm sorry. He feels kind of pathetic, but that's where it's left. Mm-hmm. And then Frodo, since he's invisible, he goes to find the rest of his friends. And then Boromir kind of like wanders out of the woods and they're like, hey, where's Frodo? And I think they go, if I remember correctly, they go look for him. Mm-hmm. And then Frodo's like, I'm, you know, turning around and leaving. And that's when Sam catches up to him. They decide to go off on their own. In the movie, I love the film, but Boromir is the most troublesome character for me because he is so obviously a menace and a danger to this mission that, you know, he's having the big speech that he gives in the climax of the book at the Council of Elders scene. That, you know, all the elves should have been like, dude, chill out. Like, I've seen people under the influence of this thing and you've got those crazy eyes. I mean, Bilbo should have realized this guy was, you know, suspicious from Jump Street. Although that's not to say that I don't love what Sean Bean does with the character. I was thinking some of that dramatic license from page to screen, TM,
yep.
doesn't quite work as far as flow.
It's easy in the cinematic world, I think, to lose some of the nuance that books are so capable of. And I think part of it is just the medium, right? Because you're kind of being given words to deal with, and your interpretation of how a character's actions are perceived can really shape what you believe that character to be. And writers are very good at playing with those expectations and, you know, setting up twists. In the movies, I think there's sometimes a tendency to be a little less forgiving of the audience. And I don't think that that is the audience's fault. I think sometimes movie makers are like, I have to ham-fistedly hand you this trope so that you understand. But that's the problem with that kind of weird, wonky Boromir portrayal, because the world building of Lord of the Rings shows you what happens to men who are in the orbit of the ring, right? And it is no bueno. It is not a good situation for them. And it's like, that's all set up. And that's literally told from the beginning. You know, the nine men, I believe they become the ring wraiths, if I have my lore correct. I don't want to make any definitive claims about the lore because I know a fair amount, but not a ton. But it's like, these men are so easily corrupted. And like, it took a hobbit, for example, thousands of years to become Gollum, or Sméagol. Sméagol becomes Gollum. Lore stuff getting correct. So it's like, that's where some of the main conflict of the book comes, is it's this kind of climactic moment of, oh, he's been taken by the ring. And there were hints dropped here and there, kind of peppered throughout. But in the movie, you kind of lose some of that journey. And it's like, you're just kind of waiting for it to happen. And part of that can be like, I've read the book, I know Boromir's fate, but like, part of it is just what the medium detracts from an adaptation. It's kind of required to do that. That said, like, watching the movie, it still is no less impactful to me, because at this point I know what happens and I'm still kind of locked in. And it sets the stage for what happens next too, because, you know, Frodo going off is kind of like an integral moment that splits the plot into two points of view, especially in the books, which is kind of jarring. And we'll talk about this more when we get to it. But like, Tolkien doesn't do, here's one chapter of one point of view, one chapter of another. He is like, here's half of a book and here's the other half, which can be a bit off-putting, but still fun nonetheless. So yeah, I think the Boromir character is a really good case study in what it takes to adapt a well-written, shape-shifting type of character onto the screen.
Well, that's the thing, is like, I appreciated more in Tolkien's text what he did with him, because he was a shifty character, but it was mostly because he was new to the group. You know, he kind of joined after they had already been, you know, gone through some legs of their journey. So they didn't quite, they were told at the outset, like, you're not going to be able to trust anybody. So they don't trust him. But there'd be little references to him watching Frodo, or Frodo caught a glance of him, you know, caught him watching him in the boat or something. Or when they meet Galadriel, the elf queen, she kind of offers a test, a very quick psychic reading of everybody in the fellowship. And they kind of talk about they each kind of confess what they were tested with. And Boromir, I think he declines, but he's very much shaken, as if she could see that he wasn't completely on the level, or at least was more susceptible to being corrupted than, say, Aragorn. Whereas, again, in the movie, Gandalf is there for a lot of this stuff. He would have been the first to pull him aside, like, I've seen that look before. What's your deal? you're staying here. We'll find another night.
Conveniently extracted from the situation so that he can't just be a plot device.
Yeah. But you know, maybe we should rewind for anyone who, for some reason, is listening to this, watching this, and has no idea what we're talking about. There's the evil ring of power, the one ring that was forged in secret by the Dark Lord, Saruman. Sauron. This is another point that always drove me crazy. Sauron is the Dark Lord and Saruman is his servant and Jesus.
This is a thing that all fantasy writers do. They're like, these are actual examples from a series I'm reading right now. They'll be like, this one's name is Caladin. This is Adolin. This is Dalinar. And it's like, you can rearrange two letters and they're all the same. So I'm with you on that one.
Well, actually, that's a quick sidebar. I'm so glad that I saw the movies before reading the book, because I had in my mind what these characters looked like. I feel like I would have struggled a lot, you know, just being left to my imagination, because like, okay, you've got the four hobbits and, you know, they're not very descriptive except sort of in their personality. Right. So I think I would have had trouble, you know, discerning a Merry from a Pippin from an Isildur who's, you know, different, and, you know, all this other, all the crazy names, and you get the names mixed up with the the eras in which they lived and the
right
countries and all this stuff. So that's a plus. But as far as what the hell was I talking about? Oh, the ring. Okay, yeah. So right, but the one ring is sort of controls a number of other these mystical rings, which are sort of divided up amongst the key members of the various races living in, you know, Middle Earth. And there's a big war because Sauron decided to basically conquer everything. But I believe it was Isildur was one of the princes of the kings who cut off the finger with the ring. And this is where Peter Jackson kind of loses me, is in the opening kind of flashback that explains everything beautifully. You're still dealing with like turn of last century, like 2000s era CGI and weird effects. I don't know that I ever would have. Okay, Sauron has this giant black knight costume. He's wearing this little ring on his like big metal clunky hand gauntlet. It just looks so dumb. I appreciate it. It looks cool when it's, you know, being sliced off and when it dissolves into ash. But when I see him like just wearing this ring, I'm like, it's like Batman wearing a wedding ring outside of his gloves.
It's very much like a quaint object to use for like, you know, a massive, powerful artifact that can literally destroy the world. And it kind of reminds me of, this is Marvel Universe stuff, but like Shang-Chi, those rings in the comics were all rings and they become like massive bracelets here to be a little more cinematically impactful. And I'm like, what would it be if it was Peter Jackson's Lord of the Bracelets trilogy?
We would never have heard about it. story or not. You can't get past Lord of the Bracelets. So Sauron is destroyed. The ring corrupts the people who come in contact with it. It's lost for thousands of years because it falls into the custody of Smeagol, who is, I guess he's a hobbit who is eventually corrupted by the ring and turned into this like little troll-like monster. And then this leads into the Hobbit stuff, where Bilbo Baggins, who is Frodo's uncle or great uncle, I guess, goes on an adventure that's not completely tied to the ring. It's almost like an artifact. He's going, you know, off to help defeat a dragon, or that's what ends up happening anyway. Bilbo gets the ring. Decades and decades later, he's retired in Hobbiton. He's fabulously wealthy, but very modest about it. And he's kind of this mythical figure within town. And this is where, you know, you kind of described the 150 pages of like boring Hobbit and stuff. I thought this was really fun and cool world building. As you put it, just a description of Bilbo in a way that I had never really imagined him. But when I'm watching the film, I see Ian Holm, who played Ash in Alien. I don't know if you remember that.
I do not.
Yeah, he was the robot, the android with the milk spewing out.
But okay, that's our Bilbo. Tracks.
Yeah,
that rings a bell now.
But I was thinking about the history that I'd read in Tolkien's book, combined with what I remember from The Hobbit. I was just thinking of that wonderful way that these things work together to form this connective tissue of, I could see Martin Freeman from The Hobbit movies growing old into Ian Holm and having all this miscellaneous, you know, wealth like peppered around. And it's just, it's the great synergy. And I think in a way that books to film have not really accomplished, at least in so far as the series we've talked about.
Yeah, there is. So, you know, kind of switching gears to the movie itself, because I could talk about any book all day long. There's a wonderment to the Lord of the Rings, especially the Fellowship adaptation. I'd never seen the extended edition, and I couldn't tell you which scenes are new and which scenes were cut for the theatrical release. I have zero idea. And I've seen both recently, oddly enough, but it feels so cohesive. I think Peter Jackson did a really wonderful job of showcasing that he loves this series, knowing what to pull and what to give fans while also like knowing exactly what he needed to tell the story. And The Shire for me is a great example of this, because in the books, I was just annoyed. Here's 150 pages of them being in the Shire and having a birthday party. And, you know, if there's a purpose to it, I get it. But that's an awful lot of time to spend before you go on an actual journey. And I get that he wrote this all as one big book. So like, technically, this is just the first 10% of the book, and that's fine. But in the movie, like, I put it on and I'm just like, this is beautiful. And it's like, so well imagined. And there's this sort of overarching idea of the visualization that movies provide sometimes being a hindrance to readers because they want to be able to visualize it for themselves. But I think you could talk to a lot of Lord of the Rings fans and they would say that Peter Jackson like quintessentially got a lot of it down pat, and yeah, that a lot of it works incredibly well. And I think part of that is a result of, you know, Tolkien comes from an age of writing that wasn't intensely descriptive. It was a lot of telling versus showing. And that's fine. It's just kind of where it came from. But like, I look at The Shire and I'm like, the way that they constructed this makes it feel so intensely real. And I don't know how much of it is effects and how much of it is practical, but looking at it kind of, it just draws you in. And it's like, even if you're here for 30 minutes before the movie, quote unquote, gets started, it's wonderful to explore the world in a visual way that just isn't offered in the books. And I think books nowadays can really do that very well. And description has come a long way in terms of prose. But like, this jump just feels so seamless to me. And it's very rare that we watch a movie adaptation that feels that way. There's so many things that it's easy to just say, well, that's not right. Well, that's not right. But in this movie, I found myself saying, that's exactly right a lot of the time. And it just felt refreshing.
Yeah, it's something that I didn't appreciate 20 years ago. But I love the description of Hobbiton, mostly because you're right, it's not a whole lot of visual information. Peter Jackson fills that in, but you're right, it does just feel right. Like he was able to get inside Tolkien's brain and pull out what he wasn't describing, you know, inch by inch, you know, on the page. But what I really appreciated was the lore of Hobbiton, like the description of why they have round doors on their houses. I just thought when I first saw the movie, like, oh, there is a house with round doors, you know, because it's just going to be different. But there's a whole history to it. And there's whole like Hobbit caste systems going back to like the beginning of the species that, you know, if you don't know that information, you know, it's fine. You're not going to miss anything, you know, in the film. But if you're watching the movie and you see, because you're right, I think a lot of this stuff, especially in 2001, there was some cutting edge special effects. I think a lot of that, I could be wrong, was, you know, in making the hobbits, you know, these full grown, you know, Elijah Wood and Sean Astin, shrinking them down so they could appear to be like 2.5 feet tall when standing next to Ian McKellen. But as far as the sets and the tools and the weaponry and stuff, a lot of that was built. Now, the very opening scene with the flashback to the big wars, that was a lot of CGI, and I'm sorry to say it shows. Like when
it looks like a real-time strategy game, you know,
when Sauron, like, it's a cool idea, and I could see the storyboard being amazing, or like being in a comic book, when he takes, you know, he basically takes his giant arm and like bats like 50 guys into the air. It's a great idea and it shows his strength, but realized in like 2000 era CGI, everything's so like weightless and kind of fake looking, and it's just bad. And that might have been what kind of turned me off when I first saw it 20 years ago, because it was like, I'm in for 3 hours of this. But now, fortunately, that's kind of the wonkiest, you know, CGI we get in Fellowship. Everything else feels very practical, or it feels very responsible in terms of the way it's rendered in CGI.
Right. As spanning and vast as this world is, the Fellowship movie, and the book to some degree, feels very personal, and it feels like a very relatable story. And it kind of busts wide open, you know, when you get to Two Towers and Return of the King, and I won't get too far into those, but just like the Fellowship is honestly such a great name for this book too. Like, you know, you can call a book anything if you're the one that wrote it, but it just feels like a very friendly movie. It's like watching these people learn about each other. And I want to backtrack slightly to what you were mentioning about the hobbits and their size and stuff. I adore hobbits as a race. And, you know, in other fantasy, they would be called halflings, you know, it's like they're one and the same, really. But it takes a lot of guts to make your main character part of a race that just doesn't care about anything else that's going on. And it's like you have these main characters that their prime objectives are partying, relaxing, and eating, and maybe smoking Hobbit leaf. It's just like, it feels so uncouth at first. It feels a little bit wrong if you're like a big fantasy person. And then you kind of realize that the only person capable, the only type of person capable of bringing this ring to Mount Doom is a person who is so unconcerned with the goings on of the larger world that the power of the ring won't affect them. And that characterizes the hobbits better than almost anything else possibly could, because it's not that they don't care about others. It's just that they're kind of content to live their own lives and just do their thing. And it's a really charming type of character, especially juxtaposed against kind of the power hungry madness of men and like the peaceful dickishness of the elves. And then there's like the brutish kind of like reluctant friendship of the dwarves. It's just very much like all of these races and cultures are so well defined, and to put hobbits right at the center is a power move from a writing standpoint, in my opinion.
How did you describe the dwarves just now? Because it was perfect.
The dwarves were brutishness. The elves are something dickishness. But now we're gonna look back at it and feel like idiots for not being able to remember.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what they are. It's just
well, no, and that's, I like that there are very distinct types of these races in the movie that all kind of coexist, but you know, they have their own kind of distinct cultures, and it's weird because they are all separate. They're inhabiting this land, but for the most part, they don't really want to have anything to do with each other, but this quest brings them together, and it's kind of perfect. Now, this movie came out in December of 2001, only a couple of months before we had, of course, 9/11. And there's no way that Jackson and company would have been working on this, you know, level unless they knew something they shouldn't have. But the whole idea of, you know, kind of American complacency, you know, we lived through the rah-rah 90s and the dot-com bubble and all that stuff, and everything is good times and, you know, endless cash for a lot of people, not all certainly. But then you've got this wake-up call of this outside force coming in and, you know, dropping a giant bomb in the middle of our shire. The Lord of the Rings is sort of the perfect metaphor for that, and trying to go back and reclaim some semblance of peace in the madness. That's another reason I love the description of the shire, is because you get these various references, these hints dropped here and there, like a word or maybe a sentence in this 150 pages of description, as you call it, to, yeah, there's, you know, sometimes you'll see like armies amassing on the border of the Shire, or strange, you know, beings kind of coming in and being driven off. And you get the sense that there is an impending danger, that the people inside the Shire, not only are they unafraid, they have no idea what could possibly happen to them because the race of men are protecting them, because they're very important. It's just, yeah, this story works on so many different layers. The movie kind of gets at that, but I think the book as a companion piece really lays it on the line for you.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's hard when you have a limited amount of time, I say, about a 4-hour movie.
Wait, I want to clarify, the extended edition, I was blown away by this, because when I looked at the runtime, I was like, God, this is really four hours. No, there are 28 minutes of end credits. Yep. On this thing.
Yeah,
a half hour.
Yeah, Aaron and I were looking, there was one like section that just listed like hundreds upon hundreds of people. And she was like, it's been 5 minutes and we're still in the G's.
Yeah.
And I can't remember what the category was, but it was, you know, some extraneous thing that, you know, like a special thanks, or it was I can't remember what it was, but it was the members of the Lord of the Rings official fan club. That's what it was. And they listed every single one of them.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, good for them. You know, that probably made each of those individuals experience. It probably was so fulfilling for them. And like, it, you know, good for you. If that's something that you value, to be in the credits of a movie, like that's pretty big in the extended edition. But there are indeed 28 minutes of credits. But Man, the movie is like, I've seen it probably six or seven times, and not the extended edition. And this is just over the course of my life, you know, just it's been on. Like sometimes I watch it passively. We'll just throw it on and play a game on my Switch or whatever. It really like, it's just dazzling. It's hard for me to put it into words, but I watch this and there's a sort of epic fantasy wonder that hasn't necessarily been captured as well or as cohesively or wholesomely as Lord of the Rings has. And I think about like, you know, Game of Thrones or The Witcher, and The Witcher is one of my favorite recent examples. It's a phenomenal epic fantasy story, but it's a little more focused, you know, on a few characters. And kind of the epic scope of Lord of the Rings is something that I think everybody's been trying to like rekindle or grasp in a way that it did. And it's, I think it's very difficult because the story and the lore of Lord of the Rings is so much a product of its time. It was like one of those original, you know, flagship fantasy stories that to create something completely original within the fantasy genre, you kind of have to like really hone in on a good character or a good cast of a few characters. And that epic scope can still be there, but now people are kind of craving those character moments. So it doesn't feel like this could be replicated, you know, and they freaking tried with The Hobbit, and I only saw the first one and was intensely disappointed. But like to get this sort of wide sweeping thing while still feeling in touch with these characters is something that I still think is unmatched in most of media, you know, especially in the cinema universe, but in books too. And I, let me tell you, I've read more fantasy books than most, and it's still hard to recapture some of that wonder. And many books come close and some even surpass it in my view. But everybody obviously has their own tastes. It's just really fun to look at Lord of the Rings and think like, this is near perfect, you know, in the way that they did it with the limitations that they had and with the story that they were building from. Like, this is in every timeline, like this is probably the best that they've done. I don't know. It feels like I'm kind of just rambling there, but that's how it feels to me. It feels so good. And well, I don't feel that way about many movies or pieces of content to begin with.
Well, I think I could be convinced, and it wouldn't take much convincing to be on that page, but it certainly feels, because we mentioned at the outset how influential these, you know, books are, and Tolkien himself, partially because if you read I think it's the foreword talking about how he had spent like several years creating this thousands of year backstory before he actually began writing the book. Right. It's amazing. But you look at the obvious descendants of Lord of the Rings, Star Wars and Harry Potter. I had kind of, you know, because I was a young idiot when I first saw this movie, I was like, oh, this is just Star Wars, but with wizards and stuff.
And just to clarify, now you're an old idiot?
Yes, yes. Okay, as I'm perfect. Sure the people watching this video will be happy to tell me in the comments. But no, I just kind of saw Gandalf, you know, Ian McKellen's Gandalf the White, or Gandalf the Grey, sorry, he becomes Gandalf the White later, spoiler, as just an Obi-Wan Kenobi knockoff, you know, this is where my head's at.
Right.
But especially reading the book and then watching the movie again with sort of new eyes, I forgot how funny Gandalf is. He's a goofy old wizard, you know, mm-hmm. He's telling jokes, he's lighting off fireworks. There's that whole scene, which I understand why they didn't do it, but it's the scene leading, you know, where they're in the mines of Moria and they're in the Great Hall and they get attacked by this contingent of orcs and other monsters and everybody runs and Gandalf holds them off. The fellowship kind of makes their way down these winding stairs, which kind of happens in the movie. But in the book, Gandalf is way up top and he holds them off. And there's like a big flash of light or something. But then I think he runs afoul of the giant monster they've got with them. In the book, he actually falls down. Yep. And like lands with a thud and he kind of gets up and shakes himself off. I think he's got like a quip or something like that. And then they go on. And then, of course, he meets up with the Balrog and dies. But in the movie, it's more just like everybody kind of goes and escapes. But I did like that levity, that charm. So when Gandalf, it's not exactly a sacrifice because he gets taken by the Balrog's whip and sucked down. And he says, you know, run, you fools, or fly, I think he says.
He's not afraid to have some fun.
It's not, but it also makes him more of a human being. I mean, I love Obi-Wan Kenobi, but, you know, Alec Guinness, the way he played him was fantastically one note. Yeah. I'll say he wasn't, you know, cracking jokes really.
Yeah, there's a, I love when humor is a part of a fantasy world, especially in movies. You know, you look at like the DC extended universe, and I feel like it is an utterly joyless experience from start to finish. And it's like, humor is a part of life, even in these kind of dire, terrible times.
Well, I would correct that just by saying, in recent years, they've kind of gotten aboard the Marvel formula train, like Shazam.
Agree.
You know, Wonder Woman 1984, a movie loathed by many, but it still has, you know, a bit of a spirit to it. That's not right.
Like the Suicide Squad, which is a fairly decent example. But I'm not going to jump into that. But I agree. There have been some kind of outliers in that scenario, and I think they're embracing it a little bit more because people don't want just all the darkness, you know. But there's something else about Lord of the Rings that I wanted to mention. I specifically made a note of this, which I rarely do. But I realize I'm saying this coming off of a huge 5-minute gush ramble about Lord of the Rings. But the biggest hurdle for me with this series, both book and movies, is the magic system. And to call it a system, I think, is doing it a massive favor. When I read fantasy, I am partial to magic systems with cohesive and defined rules. Because it means that the main character can't simply like try harder and do something amazing, right? You know,
it's like that should be a t-shirt, by the way.
And it's just like, you know, Harry Potter is a soft magic system, as is Lord of the Rings. You know, a good hard magic system would be Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn, which is a phenomenal book trilogy. But like, you know, having defined rules makes for a magic system that can be a much more defined part of a world. And with Lord of the Rings, I always find myself wanting more from the magic, because it kind of seems like when Gandalf needs to do something, he gets it done in a roundabout way. And it's interesting to some degree to me, but I think that Tolkien was so much more concerned with the history of his world. And this is not a fault. This is a choice, right? Mm-hmm. And that's totally fine if you want to build the lore of a world and that's the story you want to tell. And I appreciate Lord of the Rings for that factor. But though, that's one of the things that kind of sets it back in my mind, is I've always wondered more as to how the magic works, where it comes from, why it exists in the first place. And of course, there may be fans that tell me this is answered elsewhere. But if you have a core series within a world like this, I kind of want to know about it within that core series. I don't want to have to do a huge deep dive to figure it out. And this feels like a relatively small gripe for me, but that's just like what I look for in fantasy. And it's sad that it's kind of missing, and it's still fascinating in a way because there's an air of mystique to the magic. But I wish that veil was lifted even partially, either in the movies or the book.
You know, I didn't have that problem at all, really, except it would rear its, there was a version of what you're describing would rear its head sometimes when I was reading the novel. For example, when they're leaving the elves and they're given these like cloaks that basically are magical camouflage. You know, if you're in the forest, right, they'll turn green. If you're on the river, it'll turn like blue or black or whatever. And they describe this, but they never exactly explain how this works or what this material is made of. But I figure, it's just kind of magic. But I don't even know if it's magic or just like Middle Earth science. It's kind of like if you were to take someone from, you know, 500 years ago and read them a story that was written today, they'd be like, wait a second, how did he, what is this weird metallic horse-drawn carriage that got him from, you know, got him across the country in, you know, 5 hours? How does that work? We know how it works and why, but to explain the mechanics of the internal combustion engine, you know, in the middle of your adventure story would just kind of grind everything to a halt. I understand what you're saying. I just was more caught up in the idea that they knew how it worked, but also getting back to this kind of separated cultures thing, it feels like they all had their own way of doing magic. And I'm not even convinced they were all drawing from the same source.
Right. Well, that's, and I, that's a fine mystery for Lord of the Rings to leave on the table, which is why I was careful to say, like, you know, this is a small thing for me, because in addition, like within the wider fantasy pantheon, I think that so many writers and creators have taken that challenge or that gap in Lord of the Rings and filled it. And I think that if Tolkien had made the effort to define a magic system, we wouldn't have so many other great fantasies that focus on that specifically. So in a way, I'm appreciative of it. And I'm just like, okay, he did an amazing piece of work focused on the history and the lore, and other writers kind of filled in the gaps and did their own creating outside of that. They didn't feel like they were retreading his ground because they had new ground to tread. So I very much appreciate it. It's like, as I'm saying this, I think everything negative I have to say about Lord of the Rings just paved the way for something positive in the future. And that's probably the best compliment I can give any piece of media. If it paves the way for all the good stuff that was to come, like, I can forgive it for any and all of its faults.
Well, and this conversation is going to pave the way for more things to come. As I mentioned at the outset, we're going to be talking about Two Towers and the Return of the King. And those might have to be longer conversations, because I realize we didn't talk about most of the actors in this movie. a lot of stuff we left on the table. But I do want to say, one of the things that drove me nuts about Fellowship the first time I saw it, and it still kind of drives me nuts now, I see what they're going for, but there's so much of this, like opening up the hand to reveal the ring in the movie. It's like, wow, it's an LOTR drinking game. But on the flip side of that, I did love, I can't remember the scene it was, if it was Boromir holding, or maybe it was Frodo or someone holding the ring, but there's so much description given in the novel of the weight of the ring and how it kind of changes size in the mind of the person who's, like, you know, looking at it or wielding it. Sometimes it's very big and sometimes it's very small. There's a great effect here, and I assume it's digital, but it looks so smooth that it didn't come off as, oh, it's a computer effect. It looked like magic of a character holding a giant version of the ring, and as they kind of, like, turn it around in their hand, it shrinks down to ring size. It's the visual language of this movie is just superb.
I love it. I think much of the language of the movie, even beyond the visuals, the writing and, you know, the costuming and all of that. Well, that's part of the visuals, but you get it. You know, all the facets just really work together to create a masterpiece. It's wonderful. And I think this is one of those kind of series that if you're not feeling reading the movies will give you a lot of what the books give you. And if that's what you're interested in, like, go for it. I think it's a phenomenal avenue into the fantasy world, whether you're doing it cinematically or bookishly.
Yes. And I want to say, this is the version I read. Do you have the version that you read? Is it the same one?
I have a set of the three.
Nice.
And then the Hobbit's in here as well.
Oh, I gotta pick that up for the next ones. And I gotta say, Warner Brothers recently put, this is only a light plug, but they put out this massive, like, collection of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings in a transforming box.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. So this has, like, all of the movies and all the supplemental features and stuff in it. I watched the extended edition on my computer the way it was meant to be seen, because I had to break it up over several early mornings and I couldn't, like, put on the TV and have, you know, swords and stuff blasting through my speakers. But I'm glad that we went on this leg of the journey, and I'm excited to talk about Two Towers next year and to share with you my Two Towers story if I haven't already, but we'll save that for next time.
Well, I'm excited. I'll wait a year. I'll mark it on my calendar.
All right, sir. Well, thank you very much, Cole Rush of The Quill to Live. Have you written a review of The Lord of the Rings Fellowship?
I have not, and I don't intend to. just because, you know, nobody needs another Lord of the Rings review. I hope people will find value in our discussion here, because most of the thoughts I have are what I said here today. But quick plug, I've also started writing for Tor.com, which is the blog site of one of the biggest fantasy and sci-fi publishers. It is series/publisher agnostic, so it's not just about Tor books. And I did include a Lord of the Rings plug in one of my recent articles there about unlikely fantasy friendships. And it is not what you might expect from Lord of the Rings. It's actually more from Two Towers. But if people are interested, my work is there and on thequilltolive.com.
Well, I'll link to both down in the description. So, all right. Thank you very much, sir. This is actually, I forgot to mention, the last show of the year. So this is going up on New Year's Eve. So hopefully 2022 is going to bring not only the next part of our conversation, but a better year for all.
Fingers crossed.
All right. Thank you, sir. And Happy New Year.
See you next year.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
Bye.